I'm extremely excited to announce a brand new sponsor for the Behind the Shield podcast, and that is Rescue One CBD. For any of you who have listened to this podcast for the last 8 years, you would have heard my own personal journey from using prescription pills after a knee surgery to finding CBD and having incredible success with that. I then saw my son's wheezing diminish, my wife's anxiety, and so many more kind of success stories. The problem is, though, I've also seen the stigma and misunderstanding about this incredibly powerful plant medicine. When it comes to workplace drug testing, it's THC that they are looking for. The concentration is high in marijuana, but there is a small amount in most CBD products. And with John being a veteran firefighter paramedic himself, he was determined to find a product that was pure, that would ensure there was nothing in there that would put someone's career at risk. So he developed a three-tier system. The third-party testing facility tests to parts per billion, which is the most minute amount I have ever heard of in all the time I've worked with CBD. The results of every batch are posted on their website so you can literally see the same results that they see from the batch that you are ordering. Secondly, they include workplace drug test kits in the order when you order it. So if you have any fears, you get to do it just to appease it, even though this is a pure and safe product. Thirdly, they've just finished a year-long study with the University of Maryland and Arcadia University, and firefighters from all over the country sent in their urine samples, and not a single person failed a drug test. So you have three different tiers of trust with this particular product. Now, they have different flavors for their CBD. For anyone that's had it, that's just the CBD oil. It does not taste good, so they found a way of making it more palatable. They have a sleep remedy that has terpenes in, again, completely safe. That one's called Out of Service. And then topical CBD, obviously, for aches and pains on the outside. Now, on top of all that, Rescue One is offering you, the listener of the Behind the Shield podcast, 15% off your order if you use the code BTS, as in Behind the Shield. And you can find all of their products, you can find all of the testing, and understand why this truly is a product that you can trust by going to rescueonecbd.com. And you can listen to my conversation with John on episode 1011 of the Behind the Shield podcast. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show board member of the Shine a Light Foundation, Robert Banghart. Now, as you will hear, Robert has an incredibly powerful story from his early life, his journey into the world of addiction, how that led him into homelessness, the countless people who are homeless and live underneath the city of Las Vegas in their tunnel system, how he survived his own attempted murder, his recovery, the encapsulating community that Shine a Light Foundation creates for an addict to get themselves back off the streets and onto their feet, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Robert Banghart. Enjoy. Well, Robert, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend, Johan Hari, for even me learning, who you are. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, he's a great advocate for us. He's been a supporter and a longtime friend and mentor for many years. And thank you for having me.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
Right now, I am at the Shine a Light Foundation offices in Las Vegas.
Brilliant. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your kind of life's journey. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Oh, okay. I was born in New Jersey. I was born in a really small town in like northwest New Jersey called Morristown. Small town, rural, you know what I mean? I think back east, the town's rural is very different than what rural means than in other parts of the country. It was, you know, a lot of towns close by, and I was only 45 minutes from New York City, but I was also 45 minutes from like Poconos, Deep Woods, National Parks. So it was a really beautiful place to live. You know, I had a lot of good opportunities if I had wanted to. You know, my family dynamic is that there was a kind of a double-edged sword, right? There was a lot of alcoholism in my family, but, you know, my mom, my first memory growing up was of my dad beating my mom and leaving, and he disappeared. I never saw him ever again. So, my story is that I believe I was born alcoholic, that I was always restless, irritable, and discontent. I was always uncomfortable, and I was always very much an actor. You know, if you hear my mom say it, that I was a happy kid. And I think in moments I was. I had a decent upbringing, but you know, I was kind of gravitated towards the chaos, right? I think that was kind of my first drug of choice, if that makes any sense. Long before drugs and alcohol, it was acting out because I was always uncomfortable. You know what I mean? Some of my earliest feelings were of disconnection and not feeling a part of, and, you know, the self-love and all that stuff. And some of that stuff, I don't know, you know, maybe that was just part of being a kid. But I just don't think that to the extreme that I took it, that it was, you know. And my mom remarried shortly after, and not shortly after, in my mind, shortly after I was young, but she married a man that I call my dad, that raised me as his son, that, you know, was, you know, that figure in my life and still is to this day. And, you know, he inherited me, you know, and I was a chaotic little kid that was resentful, that, you know, would throw things in his face. And, you know, I use that analogy of the double-edged sword because he was learning how to be a dad, right? And it's easy for me to say that now, but at the time I didn't understand any of that. You know, I thought he was too harsh. I thought he was this. And, you know, he would work overnight and my mom would work during the day, and they provided a home and meals and safety, right? Like, we weren't rich, especially in the beginning, but I mean, like, I had all the opportunity in the world to live a successful life, you know, if I wasn't an alcoholic addict, but I am. And, you know, I gravitated towards bad behavior pretty young. And, you know, I was acting out. I was very, very like, I used the visual example of a round peg in a square hole. Like, that's the story of my life. I never really felt connected to anything. And even at a very young age, I had like really like twisted thoughts, you know what I mean? Like thinking of like wanting it to end and suicide and different things. Never a plan, nothing like that. But just, you know, it was very hot and cold. I was not somebody that was very balanced. And, you know, that would be the story of my life.
It's interesting. A lot of people who were either, you know, fostered or adopted, or, you know, the parent or both parents, you know, were, you know, we lost them to the overdose, or they were incarcerated, or they just simply left. That when people are older and they kind of look back and unpack it with a mature lens, there seems to be a reoccurring theme that child at that moment thought that they just weren't, you know, why was I not good enough for my dad to stay? Why was I not good enough for, you know, whatever relative to not dive into a bottle? When you look back now, do you think that was one of the root causes of the way you were feeling?
It definitely played a part. You know, it definitely played a part. I just had this thought. I mean, it's probably the first time I've thought about it since I got sober. It was, you know, very early on when my mom was, you know, trying to figure this out. Single mom, two kids. Like, she had some family support, but like, I'm sure it was hard, right? I can only imagine. I was too young to really, really understand it. But, you know, I had a babysitter that used to lock us in the basement all day long and then let us out a half hour before my mom came home, you know? And, that's not my mom's fault. My mom is struggling, doing her best to keep us together and safe. And she did an amazing job. You know what I mean? But there was things that happened 100%, right? That like traumas and different experiences. But I just don't believe that that's why I'm alcoholic, right? Like, it wasn't beneficial. It didn't help. But I think that, you know, I am because I am. And I think once you once you unpack your life and really get into recovery and start doing the work and look back with it, like you said, a clearer lens and a empathetic lens, you start to understand that, like, yes, some bad things happen to me, but bad things happen to people all the time, you know, and it's not an excuse to burn your life down. Right. And for me, it was, if I'm an addict, I have it. It's just the disease of no choice. So like, I didn't ever make a choice to burn my life down. Right. Like, it was the disease of no choice. I was powerless over it. So, you know, I look back at my mom and my dad, the man that raised me, and I have nothing but love and respect for everything they tried to do in the midst of my chaotic mind. You know, like, they did a lot, and you know, my mom went through a lot before, you know, so, and I didn't help the situation, but I have a lot of respect for what they persevered through, because they, in spite of me, tried to give me a really beautiful life. And, you know, and to this day are my biggest supporters.
I think there's a term that I've used a lot recently, reasons, not excuses. If, you know, if you play the victim, you're like, well, this happened to me and this is why I'm like this, then, you know, I disagree with that philosophy. But if you also don't look around and go, but this did happen to me and it did have an impact, then I think it kind of gets in the way of healing too. So you've got to give yourself some grace and acknowledge the things that did happen. Like, I was in a house fire when I was 4 and my parents got divorced. There were some things, you know, right. But they didn't leave me down a dark path, because I was so fortunate for all the good things, just like you're saying. But, yeah. You know, if as a firefighter, you know, for example, I'm like, oh, you know, what's wrong with me? And they're like, oh, it must have been that fire that you were on. And I'm not acknowledging the first, you know, 26 years of my life when I wasn't a firefighter, then I'm missing part of the healing. So I think this is the thing. I hear a lot of people say, you know, my parents did the best with what they had, you know, and I agree with that 100%. It's not about blame, but it's also kind of understanding that certain things, like the babysitter event and you're watching your, you know, your mom being beaten and your dad walking out, those things still, you know, had an impact on a small child.
Yeah, 100%. And like, I'm really big on perspective, right? It's something that I have to practice. Because addiction is mental health, right? It is. And I have to practice certain tools every day, and I'm not perfect at it by any means. But I think about like certain things. Like, I heard a story one time about a gentleman in India. He had been born. He was living on the streets his entire life. He was a young kid selling like rice kernels to survive and feed his family. And he went on to be one of the wealthiest people in India. And, you know, I think about that stuff to think that like what happened to me is not an excuse to not succeed or be happy. Right. It did happen to me. I own it. I can heal from it. I can walk through it. But I'm not gonna allow it to reoccurringly happen to me again, right? In smaller increments, in paper cuts, and hold me back from a beautiful life. And you know, and both sides of it is that, you know, my parents were amazing. They did an amazing job with what they had, and they provided, you know, so there's nothing that I did had anything to do with, you know, my parents.
Yeah. What about sports and exercise? What were you playing and doing when you were in the school age?
I think I a little bit of soccer, a little bit of football. I tried those things. I would always become very uncomfortable, and I would either, you know, quit or not believe in myself. You know what I mean? There's a lot of self-doubt and fear. And, you know, I remember I was 14 years old, and somebody knocked on our front door, and it's this man. I've never met him before, but it's something about him. I saw something in him that reminded me of me, kind of like, and it ended up being an uncle that I had never met before in my entire life. And he told me that my dad had overdosed and died. So, you know, and then shortly after that, my grandfather, who was like the only man in my life up to that point that I would really give respect to, he passed away very shortly after that. And, you know, so there was things that happened, right? And for me, it wasn't. Now, in retrospect, looking back, those weren't things that made me the way I am. Those were things that I used as an excuse to continue to do the things that I was doing, right? Because I was just so uncomfortable. And you know, again, in retrospect, looking back now, having some knowledge of recovery and you know, the natures of what it is that I have, I understand that I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and I was seeking relief, right? And at first it was behaviors and acting out and how I treated people and all that. And then, you know, then later on it would become more, obviously.
before the man you call father came into your life, when you look back, even though you had the undying love of your mother, was there an element of feeling unsafe in that volatile relationship with, you know, your original father, for lack of a better word?
I was so young. You know, I read a book that said, What Happened to You, right? It's a book on trauma, and it talks about, and The Body Keeps a Score, another great book, right? It talks about these traumas that happen to us in our infantile times before we have a consciousness that our body carries, but that we may not remember. And that's probably relatable to me, that there's I'm sure there's something, right, that I don't know how I'm going to be able to unpack, right, that I have, you know, looked at and thought about and prayed about and done a lot of writing on, and, you know, but I don't know. You know what I mean? I just keep, if I keep practicing this, I feel like I have gotten freedom from a lot of that stuff for the most part. And then, you know, when it pops up, I got to get back into it.
What it reminds me, I mean, firstly, you know, again, that kind of fear. I was a very anxious child. You know, I was a very meek little boy. And I look back, and again, the fire and some other things, you know, I'm sure were part of that. And, you know, you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Safety is the first thing, you know, before food and water and everything. If someone's trying to kill you, and we'll get to your personal experience of that, you know, then you're not thinking about food or hunger. You know, you're thinking about, I need to get away from this thing. Where it's interesting, because you said you never felt settled. I had a conversation with someone a while ago, and they'd written a book called what was it called now? I forget the title. It was about anxiety. It'll come back to me in a minute. But The Introvert's Edge. Excuse me. So that's what it was called. And the definition of an introvert was, you can be around people, but it's, where do you get your power? Where do you recharge? And I thought, you know, I didn't think like I'm a big extrovert by any means, but I thought it was kind of in the middle. But I'm the kind of person where if I go into a group of people, I'm fine, but you'll turn around and I'll be gone at some point. And I've just hit my wall and I'm like, all right, I'm out of here now. And so then when you look at a lot of us that weren't deep in opioid addiction, but for example, drink alcohol, and you look at people pre-gaming, which I used to do, to have a drink so you can go out and have a drink, you realize how many of us are introvert and how many of us do struggle, how many of us don't feel comfortable, you know, in these certain things. So I think, you know, yours is probably more extreme because you were exposed to certain things that maybe some people weren't. But I think that crawling under your skin, that not feeling comfortable and thinking that everyone else is the life of the party kind of feeling, I think there's a lot more people that suffer from that than we realize.
Oh, 100%. I think that everything that an addict feels, they're human feelings, right? They're not some extra feelings that we don't understand. It's just the way that we go about them, the way that we allow them to impact our lives, and the way that we take them to the extremes that separates us in that aspect, right? So everything, like, and believe me, when I was young, before drugs and alcohol was a part of my story, I just thought like I was an awkward kid, right? Like I was just not adjusted to life, right? You know, it was a lot of chaos like that, a lot of insecurity, but it didn't feel like, you know, I was sick, right? It didn't feel like, it just felt like I was awkward. It felt like I was, you know, and I didn't really at that age have a whole lot of people who weren't talking about their feelings and all the thoughts in their heads. So it wasn't like I had a whole lot of relatability with anybody. So I was drawn to those that were acting out like I was, right? That I found the, I almost want to say I went to the lowest common denominator, right? The people that would accept me for who I was and the chaos, because they were chaotic too. And, you know, so that, because we didn't have the communication skills. And like I said, I don't think you're supposed to have them at that age, but.
So what about career aspirations? When you were in the school ages, what were you dreaming of becoming?
Oh, so my grandmother was, that grandfather that passed away, his wife, my grandmother was a waitress. And in my small town, it wasn't like you needed work cards or, you know, nobody was checking your ID, right? You just showed up and they paid you cash. So I was working in a kitchen pretty young, 13, 14 years old. I was working in a kitchen. You know, I started as a busboy, kind of worked my way up. And I don't know that I really had aspirations. I think at some point I was thinking about going to culinary school, but then my life got sidetracked. I, uh, I went to prison when I was 17 years old. I got certified as an adult. So I spent 3 years in prison. I had my parents on the front lawn in handcuffs while they're searching the house 2 different times in the same week, you know? So that kind of derailed a lot of that. And when I got out, I was still in the same small town, right? And all the cops know me, they know what I'm doing. They know they know my reputation or whatever it is, the rumors. So they're pulling me over all the time and they're searching the car and they were trying to help me too. Like, again, with a clear set of eyes, I look back and I realize that there was a lot of conversations they were trying to have with me and trying to see what they could do. You know what I mean? I don't know that recovery was really mentioned, but it was just definitely about changing my life and my decision making. So after a couple of years of that, I just said, okay, I got to get out of here. I did a geographical and I came out to Vegas because I had a using buddy that was out here and he had sold me on a dream. And I came out here with, a couple $100 in my pocket, and I started working in some really nice restaurants. That was chaotic. It was, the using buddy that I had was, a lot further along the using path than I had seen before. And I left that pretty quickly, but I started working at some really nice restaurants. So I was working for Wolfgang Puck. I was working for Emeril Lagasse. Like, I was building up a nice little career, but at each of those jobs, I tell this story a lot, right? I was working for Wolfgang Puck. I was there for about 2.5 years, and I get a call from the chef. He says, hey, Wolfgang's coming to town. He wants to talk to you. At least that's what I heard, right? I'm sure he wanted to talk to a lot of people. So we sit down finally when he gets to town. And I thought for sure, like, this is my call up to the majors. He sees my talent, all these things. He proceeded to tell me about my alcoholism. You know what I mean? How I was miserable. I was, I was a hard worker, but I was always angry. You know what I mean? I was always coming into work hungover. And at that time I wasn't ready to face all that stuff. What I heard was, you're not going to value me, so I'm going to go somewhere else. And that would be a pattern for a long period of time in my life. I got married during that time. We had a kid. So she stayed with me for about 10 years and she was a saint. Like, she put up with me through like the thick and throes of all my addiction. And then eventually I spent the last 2 years of that relationship on methadone. And I'm a huge proponent for MAP medication, but I wasn't ready and I wasn't trying to use it the right way. So I would lay in bed all day long for like 2 years straight. And the only time I would get up would be to go get my dose or to army crawl through her parents' bedroom and steal their jewelry and pawn that so I can get another dose. Or, you know what I mean? It was just the tail end of my addiction. And finally she kicked me out. And when she kicked me out, I had got arrested very shortly after that. And I did a little bit of time in a county jail, no big deal. And then when I got out, I had never been homeless before in my life. So I decided to go to a place called the Samaritan House. And the Samaritan House is like the last house in the block. And they had a house manager at the time that was very stern, like, you're going to do this or you're going to get out. I was just scared enough to do it, and I did all the things I was supposed to do in my recovery. And that time through recovery, a lot of things came back really quick. Like, within 6 months, I had everything was good, and I started to believe that I was doing it, right? Like, I had figured it out. And that's how my alcoholism attacked me. So I was able to hang on for a couple more years like that. I think I got to like 3 years. I'd remarried, had another kid. I had been asked to speak at a meeting at my 3 years. And I don't know why. I hadn't gone to a meeting in so long. And I went, I spoke, and I went home that night, and my head was so loud that I put a needle in my arm and I relapsed that night. And within a month, she had found, like a needle in the trash or something, and she left. And within a month, I was homeless. I had never been homeless before in my life. And, my homelessness was very progressive. I was, I started out in the shelters a little bit, that was pretty chaotic. It was very, it's not like what you see in the movies by any means. It was very not something I would ever recommend. And then eventually I got tired of that and I started sleeping on the streets around the shelter. And then I just started camping out in different areas. And eventually I made my way up to an area called the Rescue Mission. The Rescue Mission is part of the homeless triangle where the three shelters are. And then I lived in a bando for about 2.5 years up there called the Moulin Rouge. It's like this big casino that's been abandoned for like 60 years. And then eventually the day came, one of my using buddies while I was out there said, hey, come with me. And I went with him, and he introduced me to what would be my home for the next 2.5 years. Was this tunnel that was really hidden. You couldn't get into it. Some tunnels in Vegas you can get into and walk into pretty easily. And this one was very hard to get into. And it was isolated, and it had a hierarchy. It had like a mayor, and, you know, there was some basic rules. I call it Lord of the Flies. Everybody from the outside was, you know, suspect, and we were very careful about, but internally there was a lot of chaos too. And everybody's, you know, getting high and hustling. And, you know, I'm a heroin user. I did a lot of meth while I was out there, obviously, but I couldn't do heroin in my tunnel. I had to, like, I'd get the itch to do heroin every once in a while, and I'd have to go disappear for a little while and come back, and spent 2.5 years underground.
Well, I want to just kind of roll the clock back a little bit. You know, you're crawling under your skin. You're never feeling comfortable, you know, as a child. When did alcohol come in? And then when did opiates come in?
Ooh, so for me, you hear about it a lot in recovery. People talk about the aha moment, right? They had their first drink, or they had their first whatever, and they felt like they had arrived. They felt free. And that's not really my experience. And I don't know if it's because of the head trauma. We'll get into that. But like, I don't ever remember the first time. You know what I mean? It was around. It was not in my house at all. I think my dad drank a little bit, but like a beer or two once, you know, on a holiday. It was nothing. You know what I mean? It was never in my house. But I gravitated towards that chaos very early on. So it was, you know, I was the kid that would steal a beer out of the cooler and go drink with this, you know, the neighborhood kids. And we would all do that all the time. And, you know, weed was always kind of around, even when I was young. And then I progressed, and I think heroin started for me probably 14, 15. You know, I started to delve into it a little bit, but it progressed very fast. I mean, I was in prison at 17, so it was only, you know, 2 or 3 years. And when I got out, I went right back to it. So, yeah, it wasn't – the timeline for me is a little foggy. And like I said, I don't know if some of that's just because it was always around, in a sense, in my neighborhood and whatnot, and the people that I hung out with. But also, I have some pretty severe head trauma where my memory is not – of those times, it's not as good as I think it should be, but, you know.
Johan and I have both interviewed a gentleman, Zhao Gulao, who was the man who spearheaded decriminalization of addiction in Portugal. And, you know, as a first responder for 14 years, you know, we get to see here in America the epic failure of prohibition, you know, how it's empowered gangs and dealers and, you know, sex working industry. I mean, all these areas that we see a lot of criminality coming from is down to the prohibition of drugs. What Portugal did is they took someone like you and they put them into the medical system, not the criminal system. So through your eyes as an addict, speak to me about the resistance to getting clean, getting healthy in an environment where you basically have to go to the underworld for your fix.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of guilt and shame with, you know, and that's, there's a lot of areas in life where unfortunately we put a lot of guilt and shame, right? And as an addict, I definitely felt it, right? I'm living underground, and I don't feel like I'm a part of society. I live in the same world as you, but I'm not. And even to the psychosis, right? Like I am, the mentality. I share about this a lot is we don't, the people making decisions aren't the ones with the lived experience thinking about these things, right? That it took me a month to learn how to sleep in a bed when I got sober. I hadn't watched TV in 5 years, hadn't had three hot meals in a day in 5 years, right? And I could spend the rest of this interview talking about all the things that were not in my life for 5 years, right? So when you do that, when you take away hope, right? When you have no hope, you don't plan, right? There's no need for a Google Calendar. There's nothing going on, right? I'm living directly in this moment. And, you know, I prayed that I wouldn't wake up for at least a year, year and a half, every day. I would be mad that I woke up, you know? And, but when you do that, like you take away all that outside distractions and all the basic, all of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I've just thrown them away. I don't care, right? And now I live in the same world as you, but you're thinking about what you're doing later on and when you're going to get your Starbucks and what game's on tonight. And I'm thinking about where's my next fix? What do I got to do to get my next fix? Where am I going to lay my head? All those things that the basic primal needs, right? So my Maslow's became very different than the average human being. And, you know, then you're walking around. I had four teeth. I was 120 pounds. My beard's growing out. I haven't had a haircut. I haven't showered in 5 years. Like, there's no hope in that. You know what I mean? So it completely changes your perspective on the world.
Talk to me about, you kind of touched on, you know, some of the dark side of even your shelter experience. So people assume, okay, well, people go to a homeless shelter and they've got, you know, all the things that they would need. You know, clearly there's a spectrum, probably some incredible shelters. And then, you know, we saw even during Katrina, the horrible things that would happen in a giant football stadium when people were clumped together. So yeah. What are the things that people don't realize about some of the shelters or some of the areas that our homeless are able to get into on some nights?
So what I would say is this, all I can share about is my own experience. I've never been in any other shelters but the one that I was in, so I'm not trying to group all of them by any means, and I think you touched on that. So my personal experience was that it was very much a numbers game. Fill the beds, and you know, there was one or two people working that were like the security. They were very rough, and you know, again, I can look back now, like, the crowd was very rough, so they probably had to be on some level, but it wasn't very empathetic. It wasn't conditioned. It was very get in by 10, get out by 6, and that's it, you know. And think about the guilt and shame of that, right? You're carrying everything you own all night long while you're sleeping. You're wondering if it's going to get stolen by somebody else in there, right? And then you wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, get out, and then you're walking around the street. So if I go apply for a job, I've got all my property with me. Now I've got to throw that in a bush or somewhere, hide that, hope it doesn't get stolen, go inside, apply for a job that I know I'm not going to get. You know, so it's just the hopelessness just continues to stack up, right? I like to use the visual representation of paper cuts, right? A lot of my homelessness was not these major traumatic events. There were some, 100%, but it's not. A lot of it was more slow evolution, paper cuts, just bleeding to death by 1,000 paper cuts.
I say the same thing in the fire service. You know, some of us were, for example, at the Vegas shooting, you know, and that was a very large, you know, trauma with a capital T, as they say. Yeah. But most of us, it's 10, 20, 30 years of all these calls, all these nights without sleeping. And it is, I use exactly the same phrase all the time, death by 1,000 cuts.
Yeah. Compassion fatigue, and all of it's very real.
As you are progressing through the years, you know, experiencing homelessness, did you notice any common denominators by some of the men and women that you encountered that were also experiencing the same thing?
I mean, there were some generalities. I think that it's also very individualized at the same time. So it's definitely that two sides of the coin. I think in a general way, there was a ton of substance use disorder. There was mental health. There was, you know, a lot of stuff like that. And substance use disorder is such a hard track to operate in and to work in, right? Because it's not, they have to be willing, right? And that is almost so hard to explain to anybody that doesn't exist in this space, right? That they have to be willing. You can give them tons of options, but if they're not willing, it doesn't matter, right? They have to get to a place and where they're willing. And unfortunately, none of us want this, but like, pain is the motivator, right? Pain is the motivator. And again, that's relatable to a lot of us, you know, in our regular lives, but not to the degree that they're in, right? And what I saw out there was a lot of chaos, you know, I recently, literally 2 weeks ago, went back to my old tunnel, and I've gone back a couple of times, and where I stayed at, there was another section, maybe 1,000 feet up the tunnel. And when I stayed in my tunnel, it was kind of blocked off because there was constant running water. My area was dry, but just above it was wet. So I never really went up that way. And I went back 2 weeks ago, and we dropped in, and I walked to that section that I had never really been to. And I found everybody that lived in my tunnel. They were there. They were still there. Not everybody, but a lot of them. And somebody had overdosed the night before. And it brought me back to that feeling of like, you have no idea. Like, if I'm living here, just homeless in general, let alone underground, right? Like, who's watching? Who knows that they're there? Nobody. Like, anything could happen. And I saw it happen, right? I saw shootings. I saw stabbings. I saw, you know, random cars driving by and throwing stuff and people getting in cars and I don't see them again. And then, you know, there was a girl that was homeless in my area, part of my kind of homeless family. And one day she disappeared. Never saw her again. Then I get sober and I find out that she reached out to me on social media that she had gotten picked up on a warrant, transferred back to Utah, got sober. She's married today, has kids, all that, sober. But on the streets, we thought she got killed. And the same thing for me when I got attacked. You know, I went back a year later and everybody's, we heard you died in the tracks and all this. It's like, and I say those stories not to glorify that, but just to like to say that like nobody really knows what's going on, right? Like nobody knows. Anything could happen. And that's a really weird place to be in. I don't know that many human beings feel that, right? To know that like your life is just not valued. Nobody knows. You know, like if I didn't come into work today, it's going to trigger some alarms. If I don't go home tonight, it's going to trigger some alarms. When I was out there, nobody knew where I was for weeks at a time and nobody cared. Not that nobody cared. There were people in my life that cared, my mom, my family, but like on an, you know, in that moment space, no.
Well, I think this is what makes comments like, oh, they just need to make good decisions. You know, just pull yourself out of it kind of thing is, I've said this is, you know, take out addiction for a moment. Let's just put in obesity. You know, we have an absolute crisis in this country at the moment. 70% of Americans are overweight and I think it's 45% now are obese. And, you know, I could stand on an ivory tower and say, well, all you need to do is just be like me, eat well and exercise. But that's all well and good. But you're talking to a farm boy, an English farm boy that grew up where there was orchards and vegetable gardens and, you know, acres and acres that I would be out playing. So my baseline was that. We'll take a kid from, you know, the Bronx who maybe the only playground is concrete and it's controlled by a gang. And the only place they know to get food is a bodega.
Yeah.
And I'm going to look down my nose at that kid and say, just make good choices. And it's the same with addiction. It's all well and good. And I'm happy for you that you weren't an addict, you know, judgy person. But to tell someone who's living on the street to get a job or tell an addict to just, you know, make good choices, you're missing the biggest part of the problem, which is the environment. If the environment, an addict, if they purchase the thing that they need is a crime and they get punished and penalized for it and there's guilt and shame, how easy is it for someone to say, I need help when they're living on the streets? So if we're not talking about the environment, how dare we judge, you know, the quote unquote ownership of the individual solely on its own?
I agree. And I would even take it a step further, right? The physical environment, of course, plays a part. But as an addict, the mental environment as well, right? It's so much deeper than that. And, you know, it's a lack of empathy and a lack of understanding. And I think that, you know, luckily in the last 10, 15 years, it's kind of come to the forefront more. It's out there more. It's more public now. We're beginning, you know, to see some inroads into different areas where we can really... It's officially, you know, notated as a disease. It's, you know, so there's more, but, you know, in the common man, if you don't have experience with it, you don't have empathy until it happens to you, right? Until it happens to somebody close to you. And the nature of this disease is that it does impact everybody, you know, whether they realize it or not, it does, you know, and like homelessness was not a choice for me.
Well, speak to me about the tunnels. People are like, oh, there's a tunnel and there's a mayor. You know, firstly, what structurally, why were those tunnels there under Las Vegas? What purpose did they serve?
So in Vegas, we have about 600 miles of tunnels. So if you've never lived in a desert, the ground is very hard. So it's not like, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. It rains, the water soaks into the ground. Eventually, you know, a little bit of flooding, no big deal. Out here, it's exactly the opposite. It's like concrete. It does not absorb at all. So smallest amount of rain, you're going to have 2 inches of water on the ground. It doesn't rain very often, but when it does, it's very impactful. So the city designed the 600 miles. And if you know Vegas at all, it's the northwest side of the city is higher. And that's kind of where the it opens up and comes into the city. And the southeast side is lower. It kind of bumpy along the way. But so they designed the tunnels to all run to the southeast at some point and get out to the wetlands and out to Lake Mead. So they're flood drains to help with the water because the strip used to flood. Before I moved here in 99, there was a flood where people were on top of their cars on the freeway. Like it was really bad. So it's the design is, you know, needed. And obviously unfortunately, it gives us this dichotomy that like a lot of places don't have, because homelessness is everywhere, right? But in Vegas, you've got these glitz and glammy $5 billion casinos, and right below it, these dark tunnels. And it gives this like, it's, if you're an author, it's a great story piece, right? It's a great attraction point. But we've got about 1,500 people living under our city. Like, I'll be under Caesar's Palace this weekend. So, you know, and we've been able to shine a light on the issue and utilize that to get the message out and get more help to our friends. But yeah, it's a, I don't think we're the only city with tunnels, but I think that because we're the only one with the casinos, right? It obviously gives it that dichotomy. You know, everybody wants to see it. And then, of course, there's like a lure now, right? Because it's this deep, dark underground. And, you know, when I went there, every tunnel, the best way I can tell you is that every tunnel is very different. Literally every tunnel is very different. My tunnel in the beginning had a mayor. There was some structure, and I use that term loosely, right? Like he was the guy that had the dope. He had been there the longest, and he would kind of set out some rules, but it wasn't like a long list of rules, right? And but then over time, I think he got locked up at some point, and then he stopped coming around. So it kind of turned into chaos. And then, you know, like if you go there now, there's like 6-7 people living there. So they change, and then sometimes it's very individualized. So literally, it's you know, the tale of 1,000 cities. Anywhere you went, they all have their own personality.
What is the overall philosophy on homelessness in Vegas? And, you know, is it moving towards a progressive direction? Because one of the things that nauseates me the most is people who I know subscribe to certain religions then leave their holy building and want homeless people shooed away from their neighborhood, or think that Narcan is wasted on the addict, you know, very, very non-Christian or whatever. So they subscribe to philosophy. So I've seen, you know, neighborhoods where they've literally dropped homeless off to a different jurisdiction before. And then obviously, you know, I've heard about some more progressive ones where they're actually trying to address the root causes and address homelessness that way. So what have you seen over your time in Vegas in the last couple of decades?
So again, both sides of the coin, right? There's some people in our city, a lot of our community partners doing amazing work. Holistically, there's still more work to be done, right? There's definitely more work to be done. And I feel like really where we've, if I was to sell this to you, I would ask you this, do you have life insurance?
I actually don't, because I'm self-employed.
Health insurance, car insurance?
I have car insurance. I don't have health insurance either. Back in England, I do. We have national health there.
Do you have homeless insurance?
I do not have homeless insurance, no.
It doesn't exist, right? But you understand the point, right? Like,
yes.
Most people don't think it's going to happen to them. And it's almost 7 out of 10 Americans live paycheck to paycheck. That means 7 out of 10 people that you know right now could be a paycheck or two away from being homeless. That's one car accident. That's one something. So to understand the depths of the problem is the first thing we need to do, right? And if I asked you, what is the safety net? What is the safety net where you live right now? What would you tell me? It's a loaded question. I've been asking this for like the last 3 months because it came to me in a conference, right? Where I'm sitting in a room full of people that work within the safety net, and they're asking questions. And I don't know why it came to me. When my time came on the panel, I just stopped and I said, I just started asking people in the audience, I said, what's the safety net? What's the safety net? The true definition of a safety net is any service, private to government, that helps you attain or maintain from whatever crisis you're experiencing, right? So that means that it is literally everything. It is your parents, your mom, if you, God willing, you have friends, all the way to that shelter and everything in between. And most of the in between is nonprofits, right? Some big boys, but mostly nonprofits. So we started looking at it, right, based on our own experience. So I went through detox 50 times, a 3 to 5 stay in detox 50 times, ballpark, right? The number is very big. Each time I got out of that detox, I got a piece of paper. They told me where to go, go to this shelter, go here, they'll help you. And I walk out of that place after a 5-day detox from heroin going, I don't know, you know? And what do I know? I know what I know, and that's where I'm going to go back to. And that was my experience. But that facility reported somewhere a successful completion, right? And they got more money and they kept doing what they're doing. So and that was all of our experiences, right? How the safety net didn't really work for us, didn't really work together. There was no continuity. So we started doing Shine, and Shine was founded a long time before we got involved into it. But taking it to from what it was to what it is today in about 2017. So in 2017, I might be wrong, 2017, I apologize. So 2017, Paul is interviewed by the founder of Shine a Light for a book that he's doing. And at the time he works in treatment. And Jeff Iverson's one of our mentors and close friends. He goes to him and says, listen, I want to start trying to help people get off the streets. I don't want to just talk to them. I want to do all that too. But like when they reach out for help, I want to be able to help them. Right. So he comes up with continuity case management through our iPath program. And that's a lot of words, right? Best way I can describe continuity case management to you is this, right? If you and I go to dinner tonight and it's, you know, 10 other people, and in front of those 10 people, you say, hey, Rob, listen, the parking lot was really packed when we came in. We had to park far away. I forgot where we parked, but I know I parked next to you. Can you walk me to my car and show me where my car is? Now, in front of everybody, I say, yep, I can do that. I look like a really good dude. And when I see those other 10 people later on in life, they're going to go, that's a really good dude, right? But here's the truth. I walked you halfway out in the parking lot and say, hey, listen, I got to go. Turned around, went back inside. And you're walking around the parking lot. So that's how the safety net works together, was working together, right? Not those silos, right? Nobody's transitioning. So instead of us building another treatment center, and instead of us building this building or doing this and adding to another piece to the safety net, we said, how do we help this? So we came up with continuity case management. So at a base level, we're a referral source for these facilities, right? That's the buy-in, right? On a simplistic level. I'm going to refer clients to you. What I'm asking is allow us to help you case manage. And I use this, the triangle, right? Because I'm a visual guy. At one point is the client. At one point is us, always, throughout the entire process. The other point will change as they're transitioned, but they always have us as a mentor, as a guide, somebody with lived experience and the access to the resources to help walk them through the process. That's what was missing. So until we do that, how do we even know if the safety net works? Nobody even knows what it is. Nobody even knows how they're working together. And there's all these little veins in it. These guys work with these guys. These guys don't work with these guys. I don't like this guy. Why? You know what I mean? How do we break these walls down? And sometimes they don't work with them because they're not doing the right thing. And I can respect that, right? But let's find all the people that are trying to do the right thing. And let's create pathways that can help people. Because you asked me earlier, right? Like every individual person that's homeless is an individual, has an individual story, has individual needs. So we have to be able to walk them through. We need the entire safety net to be able to help them paint their story. Because if I asked them to do it the way I did it, they might not be able to do it. And vice versa for me when I went through, right? So how do I hand them a paintbrush and help them paint their story with the resources that are available throughout the city at all different levels of care? And levels of care means they go from detox, they go into treatment with housing, then they go into sober living, into independent housing, all the while getting those the lovely catchword that every facility likes to use, the wraparound services, right? The ID, the birth, the social, and then we're meeting with them to find out what their needs actually are. Do they need job training? Do they need more treatment, trauma therapy? What is it? What's your pathway? How can we help you, right? And nobody's doing that. Nobody's doing that. They're case managed at that facility, but the second you walk out the door, you're not their problem anymore. So that's how we help build a pathway for the next 18 months, with the goal being at the end of those 18 months, you're in our life. Yeah, you're graduating our program. That's great. But you've already volunteered with us. So you're in our lives. We're going to movies, dinners. And you know, the first part of our program is outreach, right? But it's not just into the tunnels and washes. It's into the community. You know, hosting events, who we are as people, advocating, you know, I use the term layers, not levels, because levels, you know, promotes a hierarchy, but there's layers. And where can we fit in all these different layers and advocate? And then they get to see us and then, you know, the next wave and the next wave and the next wave, pulling more and more people up. So now we've touched in 9 years, 1,300 people's lives. We've got 240 active clients right now that I could tell you where they're at. And I always use this example, and pardon me for looking down. I just want to show you something real quick that is the best example. This is, I don't know if you can see it, but this is Matt. And it says today, right? I don't know if you can see it. That's today. So Matt graduated our program 18 months. I have no buy-in with Matt. I'm not reporting on Matt. I'm not making nothing, right? Matt is one of my greatest examples of continuity case management, why this succeeds, okay? Matt comes in, he's been homeless for many years. He had some head trauma like me. He had been attacked as well. He had some mental health. He reaches out. iPath is instant placement. There's no wait list. He calls. Within an hour, we pick him up. We bring him into detox. He's clinically and medically assessed for detox. He goes into detox 3 to 5 days. The triangle is engaged. He meets. They decide we're going to go into housing with treatment. So he does 90 days at Crossroads, which is a treatment facility. While there, he doesn't even know this, right? But a lot of our volunteers for our outreach and our tribe also work in treatment. So he's surrounded by an instant 10 to 15 friends that are checking in on him, talking to him. And we're all walking him off those little ledges that we all experience, right, in the journey. Levels up from that, goes into sober living where we pay for the first 3 months. So now he's got 6 months, right? Well, Matt's story is that he went into sober living and 2 months later, he's been in 7 different sober livings. Never got high, never punched anybody, right? He couldn't adjust. He had a hard time readjusting the society, finding his people. He was this and that. But each time, because of our MOUs, our working agreements with all of these different partners, we have a no street policy, which means they cannot street them. They cannot kick them in the streets. They have to call us and give us a chance to come pick them up. And that's what they did. I mean, unless they, punch somebody or grab their stuff and leave, right? Which can happen as well, but doesn't usually. 6 times they picked him up and kept him connected to the safety net, right? But nobody's doing that. You make a mistake here, you're out. We'll catch you when you land in detox again. Fast forward 2 years later, I know where Matt is. I talked to Matt. Our running joke for the last 2.5 months, 3 months has been that he stood me up for lunch because he works for the union. He travels sometimes and he works for Nevada Paving. So he's the guy that's doing all the construction with the cones. So I'm sarcastic. I love to bust his chops about it all the time and how he's ruining my life. But he was in the office about 3 weeks ago doing an interview with a YouTuber that came out and telling his story. And I got to meet his fiancee. I'm probably going to go to St. George here in the next week or two to watch him get married. That's an outcome, right? So that detox facility that I went through 50 times thought an outcome was a head in a bed, me successfully completing. The outcome really was that I went on to be homeless for 5 more years, overdosed 10 times, almost get murdered. Like that's not an outcome I want to report. I'll track all the inputs to tell a story of how I got to your successful outcome, which is that you texting me 2 years later, how you're nervous about your wedding.
That's amazing. I think this underlines so many things. Like firstly, there's this complete mythology that someone's an addict and then they go to rehab and then they're better. But everyone I know, whether it's alcohol or opiates or meth or whatever their thing has been, it's over and over and over again. I mean, you said 50, Matt, 7 times in this particular example, just trying to stay housed, but that this isn't just going to be a click your fingers and everything's good again. What I love about the oil philosophy, it reminds me of Tom Erbehart, who I had on a couple of times. He was the superintendent of Bastoy Prison in Norway. And their whole philosophy was, you've got this person, they've made a mistake, they're paying for their crime, they've had their freedom taken away. But their whole thing is, but let's turn them into a functioning member of society, because one day they will move back into your street. They will be your neighbor again. Things that 95% of all incarcerated people will be released. And so they live in a house, not a prison. It's a community. They live in a house, they cook, they clean, they go to work, they go to school, there's job creation when they're leaving. Because that's one of the biggest things I hear from the prison side is you're basically almost creating homelessness. If someone's been in 2 or 3 years, where are they going to go when they walk out? And then when you look at the Portuguese model, they took a lot of the money from the quote unquote war on drugs, like arresting addicts, and they put it into mental health counseling, addiction counseling, job creation, housing. So again, they wrapped, as you said, this particular person to a point where their environment now like forged success. And of course, there are anomalies. There's going to be people that no matter what you do, still don't find their way out. And it's tragic. But yeah, this large group that you do manage to grab, they go from using tax money to creating tax money as a functioning member of society. So this is what's so maddening, is the proactive solutions that you're, you know, doing there in Las Vegas makes perfect sense. Don't let that person go until you've got them to a place where they're truly back on their feet. Create an environment that drives success, not another relapse.
Yeah, that's why Oregon's now going to make it illegal again, right? Because they didn't do the same model. They like the idea, and that's the issue, right? You see this a lot. They like the issue. They like cookie cutter. They like to look good. But all of these issues are not look good issues. These are roll your sleeves up as a community and let's really get into this. But they don't, right? They want what makes them feel good in the moment, right? They don't really want freedom from this. They want relief. They want, you know what I mean? So it's frustrating. You know, in Oregon, they had a really good chance to be successful. And instead of putting all that money into the services, they just made it legal. And you wonder why it's chaos, and you wonder why, you know, the city's falling apart and now you want to make it illegal again. Of course it is. You didn't follow the model.
No, and exactly. I can't help but feel like that was, you know, by some maybe deliberate. Look, you see, it doesn't work. Let's go back to filling the prisons and so we can make more money. You know, if you did it properly the first time. I mean, look at the Obamacare versus national health in the country that I grew up in. At the time I grew up in, when it was still good and supported by the government, you know, no one went without healthcare. You get nailed by a bus, and the only thing they're asking you is, how are you doing? Not social security number and, you know, we're going to take your house for these medical bills. Just get better, you know. So, you know, these proactive solutions, and it just apply national health to our healthcare right now. Imagine if we had a national health 2.0 where it was using taxpayers' money. The drive then would be, well, shoot, we need to make Americans as healthy as possible so we don't use much of this tax money. Beautiful. That's a win-win. And you're going to save billions. It's the same with this. You know, if we invest in, you know, the addiction and the homelessness and the things that we've discussed, then, you know, you are going to not only, you know, solve the addiction crisis, but hand in hand, the homelessness is going to drop dramatically. And a lot of these things are going to take care of themselves. But if you just do it half-assed, just like you said, with the Northwest, then, you know, all your opposition are going to point their fingers and say, we told you it wouldn't work. Because you never did it right in the first place.
Yeah. I love what you said about the prisons. I've watched a lot of videos of prisons in Europe, not all of them, obviously, specific ones that were just switched the mentality, right? That these are human beings. They're going to get out. So let's do everything in our power to prepare them for when they get out so they can be successful. And like, but let's be fair. It's the biggest business in America. And what incentive does a prison have to not have their customers come back?
Exactly. None.
You know, like it's so much so that they've got private prisons and all. I mean, just commissary in prison is a $1 billion business. Like we've incentivized the wrong things, right? George Carlin says it best, and I don't care about his politics or even know his politics. He's a comedian. But nobody has figured out a way to monetize helping the homeless. I promise you, the second they do, it'll be Shine a Light sponsored by Coca-Cola and the Denver Broncos. I'll be wearing jerseys and trucks and lights and as soon as they do, but they haven't, right? Or they haven't tried to anyway. And like, because it's just not, it's not that important to them. Let's just be completely transparent. They're just not, there's a quote that I love. It's like, what are you willing to sacrifice for? Those are the things that, those commitments are the ones that I want to talk about, because that's what this is. Like, you have to be willing to sacrifice and you know, And I jokingly say this, right? Like, we're literally a couple of ex-heroin addicts with backpacks that are rewriting the narrative of how we address homelessness in our city. Like, could you imagine what we could do, or, you know, as a city? Like, we're just two people, you know, there's three people that started, and now it's, you know, 250, 300 volunteer force and, you know, seven employees. But like, still, like, how did we figure out to navigate the safety net and make your net, your safety net work together.
Yeah, I say the same thing. How did a moderately intelligent, median level Englishman who just happened to come over here and become a firefighter figure out some of the things that I've been talking about when it comes to the mental and physical ill health of our firefighters, when there are chiefs and unions and, you know, all kinds of people that are paid a huge amount of money to address this very thing? So I completely understand. Like, I am not an intelligent man. I am not a veteran of the fire service. I only spent 14 years. You know, there's people that spend 30, 40 years. Why me? You know, why, where is everyone, you know, where is the help? And so I think this is an important question. What needs to happen in Las Vegas, to stick with your city, to give you guys the support to actually be able to apply this to all of the people experiencing homelessness?
We've been growing at a great pace and gaining support and gaining, you know, for us, it's a nonprofit. It's always about money, right? We're all constantly trying to raise money, and we've kind of, We're not an organization that's ever going to take restrictive funds, right? We believe in what we do, and that's what makes us successful. So constantly raising money, constantly talking about it. We're massive advocates. I speak anywhere I can, and just to talk about this issue and put it in front of people, because I think that's really what it is, right? Like, I think there's a section of people that just don't know, right? And then there's a section of people that don't want to know, right? That just don't want to, either don't want to believe it or don't think that it's real or whatever it is, right? Because growth and awareness, it takes a certain amount of uncomfortability, and it smashes certain illusions, right? Like, that I like my illusions sometimes, right? And facing that stuff, which is vital to any kind of change, is hard sometimes, you know? Like, they don't want to believe it, or, you know, they don't want to believe that it's happening in that part of the city, because that's the nice quiet part where they live. But like, this is, it's all about humility and understanding that these are community issues. It's not going to change until we all come together. But there's so many, a lot of times, you know, with a lot of issues, there's a lot of interests, right, in different ways. And, you know, I don't know, it's, we're doing great work and it's happening, and we have tons of great partners. And like, I feel the needle moving, and I feel like the perspective is changing, but never at the pace that it needs to.
Why do you think it is, in such a faith-based country, that, for example, in the Bible, just to choose that one, because that's the one I know, that's what I was raised on, you know, Jesus is out there anointing the feet of the poor and, you know, counseling sex workers and all the things, yet there's such a resistance when it comes to the homelessness, the you know, truly empathetic, proactive solutions to the homelessness and the addiction. I struggle with the fact that someone can walk out of one of those buildings and then, like, as I said, be, you know, move on the homeless, get them out of my community, or stop wasting Narcan. I see a huge disconnect between the true goodness that I know exists in these holy books and clearly the messages that these people are receiving. So you mentioned that there are some beautiful nonprofits, and there's a lot of them that are churches and other faith-based things that are out there walking the walk 100%. But why do you think we have as much resistance when we're supposed to be such a faith-based country?
Well, what's the opposite of faith? It's fear, right? Fear is a lack of faith, and fear on many levels, right? That it could happen to them, that, you know, and then it's, you know, some lack of empathy. Why are you, you know, they don't want it around them, almost like as if it's going to get on them, right? Like, so it's just, yeah, it's a lot of fear. It's a lot of fear.
Well, you touched on the head trauma and your attempted murder. We haven't really got to you leaving the tunnel. So kind of talk to me about kind of what the, if any, factors were leading to that attack. And then let's talk about, you know, that, and then you turning the corner yourself.
So my hustle when I was out there was like a, you know, low bottom dumpster diver, crime of opportunity, real petty stuff. I wasn't really, you know, a hardcore person, but, I was always the guy that would get stuff for people. They'd tell me they needed it. I'd go find it, you know, steal it, whatever. And this particular day, the last day that I was out there, I think I had come up on a dumpster where there was like an eviction, right? And I find the suitcase, and it was obviously somebody's personal property that the company had thrown out as they were, you know, doing the eviction or clean out. And it had a whole bunch of stuff in it, right? And you know, electronics. So I just grabbed it and I took off. And nothing about that was illegal, right? So I go through my neighborhood in the area that I was living at, where my tunnel was at. There was the Cubans ran my neighborhood. They controlled all the dope for us. And so I would always go by and give them something whenever I came up, right? I would always kind of like a tribute, I guess you would say, right? Like, because they always watch out for me because I was always doing something. They'd always be like, hey, this guy's looking for you. Hey, we heard this, whatever. I thought anyway, you know what I mean? Maybe that's just some of that was probably delusion from being out there for so long, but there was a lot of interactions. And so when I went through and did that, I think I flashed. I think I opened it too wide. I think somebody saw that I had. And so I left there, went to my tunnel. And my tunnel was, there was some train tracks. They call it the homeless highway. So maybe 1,000 feet down from where my tunnel was on these tracks was 4 businesses. And if you didn't live in the area or know of them, you would have no idea they were there. They didn't face the street, really dark. And none of them are there right now, so I'm not even sure they were legal. But I went to the 4th business and I dropped off all that stuff I had found, because it was a guy that I used for stuff like that. And he told me to come back. It was a lot of stuff. He wanted to check it out. I said, okay. I left. I went and got high. I came back. And when I came back, it was dark. And as I was walking up, I saw 3 guys that I knew waiting outside, and they had a hatchet, a knife, and a pipe. And I knew exactly what was about to happen, because we were kind of like competition out there. We had the same hustles, and I had never really liked them. And but I also, you know, the true nature of what it is as an addict, on the other side of them was what I needed. I had to get there, right? And so Maslow's, I don't care about my own safety. I've got to get to this. So they attacked me. They hit me with the hatchet in the head a couple of times. I've got all the scars and, you know, cracked my skull a couple of times, hit me with the pipe a bunch of times. They lacerated my liver. They stabbed me in the leg, and they dragged me onto those train tracks right there, and they left me for dead. So the first business, not the 4th, the first business, there was an overnight security guard that I had fostered a relationship with over the years. We would get high together sometimes. He'd feed me sometimes, and he was a relatively decent guy. And I had no idea he was working that night, but he had been working that night, and he saw it all happen, and he called the ambulance, the cops, and they came, pulled me off the train tracks, and I'm dead. And they revived me. So I wake up. I still think I'm fighting for my life, and, you know, I'm bleeding blood, and I got a knife sticking out of my leg, all kinds of stuff going on. And they hit me with morphine, and the train is coming by. So it's loud, like I'm just complete chaos. They hit me with some morphine, and I died again. And I woke up in the hospital 3 days later on life support, and I woke up to a nurse. I'm strapped to the bed. I've got all the bells and whistles going on, and she's yelling at me. I still think I'm fighting for my life, so I'm flailing around, doing my best to whatever, and I feel a hand touch my forehead, and I hear the words, calm down, and I felt the presence of God in that room. So, you know, God came to me through a shot of morphine on life support. And from there, I spent the next 4 or 5 days there. Then I was transitioned into a physical therapy hospital, where I spent the next month. I had a broken jaw that they couldn't wire because of the swelling of my brain, you know. And if you're early in recovery, it's a really beautiful thing. I wouldn't recommend getting hit by an axe, but if you are, it's actually really a good thing, because it really affects your memory. So all my anger, my resentments, my fear, it would go away. I would forget it, you know. And my fiance would say that some of that's carried with me to this day, but, you know, I think it's gotten better. But, you know, and I'm joking, but like in that hospital, really what happened was a gentleman that was has become my best friend, and our director here, our president of Shine, is came to the hospital and just offered me the next step. You know, he told me a lot about how my family had been looking for me, and, you know, kind of unpacked a lot of what the last 5 years looked from their perspective. And he offered me treatment on a scholarship. I just said, okay, that was it. You know what I mean? I didn't say okay to what my life would be like for the next 6 years plus, but I just said, okay. I knew in that moment that if I didn't take this opportunity, if I went back to being homeless, I was going to die. Like that was as close as I had ever come to dying in my life. And I knew that it wasn't going to get any better. And I also felt like I was really frail. Like I wouldn't even be able to defend myself. So I said, okay. And I started my journey.
What worked that time? Johan wrote the book, Chasing the Scream, another one, Lost Connections, but there's a quote that I love. He said, the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And when you look at even some of the biochemistry when it comes to some of these substances, you know, we assume that, you know, one hit and you're hooked and it's the substance. But more often than not, as you mentioned with the mental health side, the substance is, you know, a lot of times just filling a void for a person. It could be anything from social media to porn to gambling or opiates and alcohol. What worked this time that stopped you relapsing when you'd had a, you know, a 50 count years prior?
Pain. I was broken. You know, like, that's not everybody's story when they come into recovery. Everybody is broken spiritually or mentally, but like, also I was physically broken. Like, that was the lowest point of my entire life. You know, I was 120 pounds, broken jaw, lacerated liver, stitches, staples, you know, just so frail and so weak that like, I just didn't have any more fight in me that day. You know what I mean? And I just kept winning days. That's it.
That inability to settle that you had as a kid, did that start coming out when the sobriety was, you know, forced on you originally?
There was a lot of uncomfortable moments. You know what I mean? Like, you're unpacking a lot of stuff and that's not going to be an easy road, but I don't know that it definitely wasn't bad. You know what I mean? There's a perspective change that has to happen, right? Like, I'm seeking relief. I'm seeking instant gratification, and nothing about recovery is instant gratification. It's freedom, which is a lot of hard work, and it's completely worth it, you know, but it's very hard to understand that, right? Like, our director says this all the time. It's like, when you do outreach, think about this, okay? If I walked up to you right now, James, and said, look, great life, beautiful life, here's the deal. Come with me right now. Leave everything you know. Come with me right now, and I'm going to give you a life that's 10 times better than the one that you have. Could you do it?
No, because I would assume that my life now was as good as it was going to get.
So why is it any different with homelessness and addiction? Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Right? Like, I used that analogy earlier of the paper cuts, right? Like, my life had become so small that a backpack and a little spot in a tunnel was my entire life. And if it all went away, as long as I could start over, I'm a survivalist, right? The mentality was, right? Like, so my world had become so small that was my world. And now you're asking me to come in and go to detox and go through a crippling heroin withdrawal, go to treatment, do this, do that, be here. The world seemed so big, overwhelmingly big, that it didn't seem like I could ever do it again. And then you factor in, like, you know, I'm 42. I think I've wasted my whole life. You know, I've abandoned my family, my kids, all these things, like the weight of all that. And now this guy is telling me, so if I hadn't been in that pain, because like, I had been in recovery before, I knew where there were services at, right? Like, I never tried to access them. That's my story. You know, so in that moment of complete defeat, physically, mentally, and spiritually, you know, I feel the presence of God. It wasn't enough for me to build a relationship with him, but it was like this. I use the analogy, like, there's a new player at the table, right? That's my Vegas analogy. I had never felt that before. I had never had an understanding that there was anything higher than me, right? And not that I had been in situations before where I knew other people were in control and all that stuff, but I'm talking about like on a spiritual level, I'd never felt that. And just that alone was enough for me to go, okay, just okay. And it would take me a while to build a relationship and faith and all that, but that it happened, you know?
What about the tools that you use? I mean, again, you know, you're dealing with a life of trauma, you know, some, as you said, contrasted with an absolutely loving household that you grew up in a little bit later. But, you know, there's things that had to be dealt with. There's voids that had to be filled with kind of healthy coping mechanisms. There's traumas that had to be processed. I don't think people realize how vast the toolbox is. And now, you know, in 2024, we're realizing that even, you know, psychedelics and some other things that we were never thinking about before are being very effective, especially in military and first responders. So what were some of the things that you started using to kind of, you know, as a rung on the health ladder that you were climbing?
For me, it was a spiritual fellowship. You know, I was surrounded by guys that were, you know, of the same disease, that were, you know, working a program and, you know, and service, right? Like I'm not somebody that's trying to tell anybody else how to heal. That's not my business, right? Like I think we all have to have our own ways to do that. And none of them are better than any. Whatever works for you is the way, right? And for me, really without my permission, it was service, right? So I was able to take that restless, irritable discontent, that energy that I had running all over the place when I was homeless, hustling and all that, and shift it into service and giving back, really, right? And complaining the whole way, you know what I mean? Because I'm new in recovery and I'm miserable and all that, but I did it. I showed up, right? In spite of me, I showed up. And for me, what I realized is that I healed from a lot of things in service to other people, right? I found self-worth. I found all these things. And, you know, and in the long run, I found a relationship with a higher power that I can do business with, right? Like service helped me to find my faith. That's what worked for me. You know what I mean?
I've lost count of how many times, firstly on the bad side, how many times I've heard of a first responder or a member of the military struggle once they transition out, whether they're fired, whether they got hurt, whether, you know, they retired, because that was their tribe, but that was also their purpose. You know, they got up every morning and like, I'm going to go on a fire engine and help people who are hurting for 24 hours. Conversely, people that have been through their own struggles, I've watched this kind of beacon of light element emerge where once they've actually healed to a point, I mean, obviously you're on a roller coaster forever, but that kind of aha moment where people came out of the shadows and said, hey, I'm hurting too. And because they see themselves in that person. Was yeah. there a moment or was there a kind of period where you kind of realized, oh, wow, I'm not even so much the recipient of the healing now. I'm actually able to use my story and use my scars to help other people.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of them. You know, I think in doing outreach, because I got involved with Shine as soon as I got out of treatment, because Shine at the time was based in that same treatment center that I went through. And I just started going out with them and talking to people and getting to know them. And at that time, I'm only 3 months off the street, so I knew a lot of people out there, right? And they knew me on a personal level, and they saw me, you know, gaining weight. They saw me, you know what I mean? So it was those little examples of things that they were starting to see in me. And then, you know, you start to build up stories of like the people that you interact with and how you're able to show up for them, right? And like in the beginning, I think there was very simple things. It was like, you know, I'd go pick them up, or I'd, you know, show up or just talk to them, spend time with them, right? Like little things that I could share with them at that time that impacted them and me. You know, I can remember being like, I think I was like six or seven months sober, and I'm living in a sober living, and I walk in the bathroom, I look in the mirror, and it's the first time in my entire life that I was ever just okay with what I saw. Not high, not low. I was okay. I had always been uncomfortable, you know, and it was the first time I was like, ooh. And I couldn't tell you what specific thing that I was doing that led me out. It was all of it, right? And in spite of me, you know, because it wasn't like enjoyable for me to be of service in the beginning. I was really going to hang out, or I was doing it because I was directed to do it and, you know, didn't want to be homeless anymore. But that's okay, right? Like willingness looks like what it looks like. It doesn't matter as long as you have it.
One of the things I think that made the Portuguese model so successful when it came to decriminalization of addiction was if, you know, you and I were in a car and we got pulled over and we both had a user's amount of anything, you know, it can be meth, it can be heroin, whatever it was, we're not arrested. We're simply detained and, you know, put into almost like an educational conversation on the resources that are available to us.
Yeah.
And so that way you're not being told, we command you to go get rehab. You know, we command you to go get this mental health counseling. What they're doing, they're removing the criminality in the first place. So again, that guilt and shame is gone. You know, that then lures a lot of people to ask for help because they're not worried about, am I going to get locked up in the process? But also there's that autonomy. And I think this is important. You know, people have said, oh, we try programs here where we send people to rehab. It's like, yeah, but did they want to go to rehab? Like you said, were they at that point where they were ready to get help? And this is what I think is great about the Portuguese model is now you create an environment for that individual to say, I need help, and help is everywhere. Like, you know, I don't have any problems finding help versus, you know, this, I command you to get sober mentality in some of these programs that just out of, you know, not spite's the wrong word, but the fact that someone of authority told me I need to go and do that thing might in turn, just that dynamic have the equal and opposite effect. Like, no, I'm not going to go because you told me to go.
It's like, you know, it baffles me. It baffles me. And it's like, they don't understand what it is, right? You don't understand the disease. You don't so education is vital. It's vital. And empathy and understanding. We need to really look at what it is. And addicts and alcoholics by nature are defiant by nature. It's an earmark of what it is that we have, right? And if you're creating environments of guilt and shame, then you become the enemy, right? It almost becomes this, like, regardless of what it is, even going into treatment becomes the enemy, because it's just, I have to go, I have to do this. It's like, there's a lot of that. There's a lot, like, even in Vegas, we have the camping ban now that's coming online here soon, right? It's like, it's a lot of, I use the visual representation of house painters. A lot of people in big offices like to come up with these glorious ideas that, look at the, imagine if you're painting a house, right? Let's say homelessness is a house and the house needs to get painted, right? Somebody will come up with some great idea to get a bunch of funding. And what they'll do is they'll get that big spray gun out, right? And spray the whole house with a new coat of paint. And look, the house looks beautiful. But like, how do you paint a house with a spray gun when it's, you know, all these intricacies? We've got to get out brushes. We've got to look at this. We've got to, but they don't want to do that, right? They want to throw some money over here, this new facility we've got, and look, it's going to be great. And then with with addiction, like, how are you, you're going to punish me for a disease? The scary part about it is, right, that if I had cancer, you wouldn't do that, right? But because I steal from you, it's any more or less a disease, or I deserve any more or less empathy. And I'm not here to say that people shouldn't be punished for crimes. I'm not saying that, you know, some addicts won't need to go to jail at some point. I get it, right? But to say that that's our holistic approach to humans is just not. But like, I could sit on that soapbox all day long. You know, like, so many issues of, like, kindness is nobody's trigger, right? Guilt and shame is everybody's trigger. So why, when you're trying to foster connection, connection to services, connection to all of these things, guilt and shame is not the way to go about it. Like, and then we can go deep and further, right? How did the drugs even end up here? You know what I mean? Like, but that's a whole nother episode.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the statistics, the US makes up 4% of the world's population. We consume 75% of the world's opioids. We have almost now 25% of the world's incarcerated people. So if the war on drugs worked, then we wouldn't have gangs, you know, and we wouldn't have, you know, homelessness everywhere. Like, we'd be the model, you know. But I would argue that, you know, parts of Scandinavia and Portugal are the model. You know, we it's an epic failure. And it goes back to the 30s. Harry Anslinger is the origin story. So clearly what we're doing isn't working. It's just that simple. And, you know, for me, like, for example, witnessing the absolute failure, you know, in uniform of drug prohibition, I'm a huge advocate for, you know, the Portuguese model or even complete, you know, legalization. But I saw decriminalization because that was empathy for the addict. But, you know, you're not legalizing certain things because obviously there is a gray area. You know, marijuana, for example, is having a lot of healing elements. So, you know, psilocybin and MDMA. But then you've got crystal meth and some of these other ones that arguably maybe aren't really, you know, benefiting society. So you could still have classes. But, you know, to me, just abolishing the prohibition of drugs, full stop, and, you know, decriminalizing addiction, you know, not only will free up resources to get the smugglers, the dealers, just like you pertain to, but, you know, free up the court systems, minimize the amount of time people are either in custody so they can actually, you know, post bail and get out and go back to their family. You know, the upside to me is amazing. And the longitudinal study has just been an epic failure. And I've witnessed it. You know, I've scraped the bodies off the streets for 14 years. If you could be king for a day, what would be all the pieces that you would put in place to proactively make a huge dent in the issue that we've been talking about the last hour or so?
Ooh-wee. I think one of the greatest things I've heard, a year and a half ago, I was at a conference and a doctor came up and he was the opening speaker. And he said that, how many people here think that the system is broken? And everybody, of course, starts clapping and yelling. And he goes, it's not. He's like, the system as it's designed works for exactly the people it was designed for, by the people it was designed for. He's like, that's the problem. He's like, it needs to be blown up because it was not designed for us, right? So it's not a current system in the situation that we're in. But if I was king for a day, you would have to look at every issue. How are they getting in, right? All the way down to the attic, and support all of those services. Like, you can't have a jail or a prison where there's no reformatory. You can't. It's impossible, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, to isolate somebody in a prison with other prisoners where they're not getting any help they need, all it's fostering is further criminality and addiction. So it's negative into negative into negative. So how do we turn negatives into positives? How do we turn those at every step, right? I'm a huge proponent for harm reduction, all of it. Safe use sites, I'm a huge proponent for all of it. But they never support it the way it's supposed to be sorted, right? We have a camping ban in Las Vegas that's about to come into effect where it's going to be illegal to camp on the streets. Illegal. And like, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't really have an issue with the camping ban. I have an issue with the fact that we start with the stick before the carrot. The carrot's not even in place. The cart's in front of the horse. It's Oregon all over again, right? And because they want to clean up the streets for the businesses and the casinos. And like I said, I'm not so unempathetic that I don't understand that somebody taking a shit in your front of your business is a bad look for your business. But holistically as a city, we've got to look at and ensure that we have these pathways created that when the person is willing, you know what I mean? And I'm not even saying that the jail can't play some part in it, but why does jail have to be such a drastic difference from everything else going on? Why isn't the rehabilitation happening in jail? So that when they come out again, they're connected. Why aren't, like, the safety net needs to work together to be a true safety net. Right now we have safety bubbles, and hopefully you land in one of those bubbles. And when you're out of that bubble, good luck. That's not a proactive approach. So I think for me, it would be continuity through all things.
Beautiful. Well, I want to throw a few closing questions at you before we make sure, you know, we talk about shine a light and where people can contribute. First question, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Ooh, wow. So many good books. You know, obviously, Johan Chasing the Scream was the game changer for me early in my recovery and still is to this day. I like to go back and walk through it. But more recently, I've gotten into a friend of mine, Ryan Hampton, wrote a book called Fentanyl Nation. It's a really good book. And then I have a personal favorite that is, you know, been impactful for me. It's called A New Pair of Glasses. It's a really cheap $5 paperback that changed my life. Know what else? I think I mentioned What Happened to You, The Body Keeps a Score. Those are great books, trauma related books, and how the pathways of the brain, how trauma affects you. And you know, one of them was a book by Oprah, so I didn't see that one coming, but it was good.
That's yeah. Funny, but with the title of the book, that's, I forget who said it to me, it's not that I had this thought at all, but someone said, you know, don't ask, you know, what's wrong with you, ask what happened to you. And as I've had over 1,000 conversations now, that's absolutely the thing. Everyone has an origin story. And then I just wrote my own second book that came out a few weeks ago. And there's a multi-generational trauma story element, you know, woven in as well. And it's not just, you know, your own experience as a child, but what happened to your parents, what happened to your grandparents. There are these dominoes that are falling that, you know, will continue going through these generations until one of us actually stops and, you know, won't let that last domino fall. But yeah, so I love that phrase, you know, what happened to you rather than what's wrong with you? You know, snap out of it, get a job.
It's that the lack of empathy we expect from people to, you know, It's like that when we don't have empathy, it's like they're bothering us, right? With their thing, what's wrong with you? It's like, no, let's dig deeper. Like, if you really care, but that's work. You know what I mean? And I'm not perfect at that. I'm walking through some stuff in my personal life right now that I'm being reminded that I need to get better at that. You know what I mean? So it's a journey and a process, believe me.
You mentioned earlier about your kids. I just had a Navy SEAL on, and it was actually his father that was deep in, it was meth addiction with him. And he was talking about, it was psychedelics, ironically, of all things, that was the kind of corner turn for his father. But then, you know, he was talking about the healing. Like, okay, now you've overcome your addiction, but you've got this wake of destruction and pain that you've left. How do you then start picking up the pieces and trying to heal these relationships? What have you been able to do with your own?
For me, I haven't been able to. One of my kids is an adult, and I've reached out several times and gotten no response. And then one is 10, and her mom will not let me see her. So first of the year, I'm going to have to get a lawyer and do all that and go down that road.
I'm sorry to hear that. I've got a friend that he went through a divorce, and his daughter didn't talk for him for years, but then she came around. And I do hear this a lot. I mean, you know, hope is, you know, a superpower, of course, but you know, I hope that one day, you know, your oldest will hear a conversation like this and maybe find a little bit more compassion and forgiveness. Because I get it, you know, when people are hurt, they're hurt. But again, when you really hear where that all came from originally, hopefully that will kind of, you know, crack the door of that conversation again.
Yeah, I hope so. It's something I pray about every day. You know, Johan actually wrote a letter to one of my children's mothers for me on my behalf. And it's kind of, I do a lot of work on social media and a lot of speaking and all that stuff. And a lot of it is because my mom's watching, right? Like, I want my mom to be proud for the first time in her life. Like, she has a son she can be proud of. But I think some of that too is that, you know, maybe someday my daughters will look at that and think, okay, you know what I mean? Let's.
Yeah, I hope so. I really do. Well, we talked about books. What about films and documentaries that you love?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm a huge fan of City of God. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I don't know if I saw that one, actually. I'll write it down.
It's out of the favelas in Brazil. It's a true story about a photographer that grew up in the favelas in Brazil, and his journey through all the chaos and how he overcame it was a really great movie. What else? I'm trying to think here. What else? Move Me No Mountain was something that we were kind of a part of a little bit. It was a story about homelessness that just was filmed here in Vegas with a friend of ours. That was really good. And then I'm trying to think. In the moment, I can't think of anything else. I love movies. I get to watch not a lot of TV, but I like to watch TV.
Beautiful. Yeah, I had a guy on Judge Craig Mitchell, and he was the subject of, what was it called? Skid Row Marathon. And he was a judge, and again, you know, had a lot of addiction, a lot of homelessness kind of come through his courts. And so he was a runner, and he started just, you know, inviting the local, you know, whether they were homeless, whether they were struggling with addiction, and ended up like competing in marathons around the world. And again, such a beautiful story of just one person caring enough to do something. He's already paid to, you know, to help, to be a public servant, but he went over and above and, you know, just created a movement there in Los Angeles.
I like a lot of YouTube. I like following YouTubers because I get to see different parts of the world, you know, different perspectives that I didn't think. Like, that's kind of how I found the jails, the prisons in some prisons in Europe were there. You know what I mean? And even found in Romania, there was tunnel people living in the tunnels, but their tunnels were very different, like Eastern European style tunnels, like steam tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw that. I like that. I like seeing different, like, it was really impressive. You know what I mean? I think it's super important. The rehabilitation factor and the way they took away shame was, by the end of, at the one that I saw, by the end of it, they never wore prison clothes, right? They always wore their own clothes. And by the end of it, they had had weekend passes. They had had a job outside of prison, right? Like, so that there was no jump off the cliff, right? Their family had seen them, knew they were there. They were connected with their family, their employment. And as a community, it destigmatized it too, right? Because they're used to seeing him, and it was beautiful.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is what I've said. You know, we beat our chests and say we're the greatest country in the world. And I always say, well, firstly, it's not a competition. Like, we're a round rock. We're all on it. You know what I mean? But secondly, we're not. You know, if you look at education, if you look at, you know, the addiction, you look at the violence in our schools, you look at the obesity crisis, we're not winning in every area. And the problem is, because of that arrogance, we're not having the humility to say, Norway, you know, tell us about the prisons. Portugal, tell me about drug, you know, decriminalization. In, you know, UK, tell me about the original NHS, not the one that you've destroyed, but the how it was supposed to be. Because then we can go, okay, well, it's not apples to apples, but let's take that blueprint and apply it to, you know, make an American version of, you know. So having the humility to ask people who are already doing it better than us, I think is how we really kind of move forward in a lot of these issues.
Yeah, 100%. You don't know until you know, so you got to find somebody that does.
Exactly. All right, well, the next question, is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
I would recommend probably Jeffrey Iverson, Jamie Hatfield, Brent Nowak. I've got a good group of guys around me, guys and girls.
Beautiful. All right. Well, then the very last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find Shine a Light Foundation and yourself, what do you do to decompress?
The last couple of years, not much. No, I enjoy it. It's my purpose, right? So I have a beautiful family at home that I get to spend time with from when I can. And just recently helped my fiance to open her business. So she started a business, which is going really well. And little things, you know, date nights. And, you know, we're just really active in our recovery. We're really active in the community. So, and I enjoy those things. We're going to F1 on Saturday.
Brilliant.
I'm not particularly an F1 fan, but I'm going for the event, you know, and be with friends, right? I get to show up for people today. I get to be, yeah.
There's a lot of money in that sport. If only you get a sponsor from the F1 community to help with homelessness in America.
Yeah, we got a call from them. They, you know, reached out to us. This came by the office and you know, we thought maybe there was a chance, and still they gave us tickets. They just wanted to partner with somebody to give us tickets, gave us all free tickets to go. So it was beautiful.
Yeah. Hopefully that will lead to a further conversation then.
Yeah, for sure. I think what we've seen in Vegas a lot, and I don't know where anywhere else, but in Vegas, the narrative is changing, right? People are getting tired of the old guard and the old way, and not that they want to tear them down, right? But what else? How can we add to this? Okay, we've been supporting this for a long time. You guys are self-sustaining now. Let's go out and find the next one to prop up. And how do we help this? And I think ideally we're perfectly suited, right? Because we're essentially the piece that works with everybody, the piece that connects all the pieces, the piece that can, and then report data for 18 months. Nobody can do that. We can report data for 18 months that people can do 3 months, 6 months tops. And then we can track all these things for a long period of time. So,
yeah. Well, and true successes, like you said, not just coming out of a rehab facility after 5 days, but actually someone transitioning back to a home and a job and truly, you know, being back on their feet.
Yeah. We got a graduation, our board downstairs, we have the, you know, where all our clients are placed. And then we have another board for a graduation. So far we have 70 clients for our March graduation, and we're working on like 30 more possibly.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah. Well, for people listening then, where can they learn more about Shine a Light Foundation? How can they donate? And, you know, where are the places online or social media?
So website, www.shinealightlv.com. That's the same for our Instagram, Shine a Light LV, Facebook, Shine a Light. In the Instagram, it's in our bio where you can donate. We have a match grant going right now, so every dollar donated is automatically doubled by our board. So it's a great opportunity to maximize your money and just shoot us a like, a post, a follow. Just, yeah, we're pretty active on our social media and we do it all ourselves. So
beautiful. Well, I want to say thank you so much, Robert. It's been such an amazing conversation. Just your life story, obviously, on its own is incredible. But what I love about the human beings that come on the show, the common denominator is these are people that have either been through horrendous struggles or, you know, have served in uniform or, you know, judges, you know, I didn't say costume, but whatever, whatever you call it, they were, you know, and then they just want to do more. They want to keep serving. They want to be a bigger part of the solution. And to go through the crucible that you went with your addiction and come out and be this incredible beacon of light with this community that you've built has been, you know, so amazing to hear. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.